Welcome to the Daily Review. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a few subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the pending war in Colombia. This is a 40-year-long civil war, but it is about to get hotter. We'll be talking about that with a Colombian who's a co-director of the Colombian Support Network. We'll talk with Leonard Weinglass, a well-known attorney. He's representing five Cubans convicted of espionage against the United States. We'll also have a debate between a guest in the studio who is a board member of the Iraq Foundation, and we'll have on the phone George Lopez, the Director of Policy Studies and a senior fellow at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. But let's begin with a news update from Justin Stinchcomb.
Thanks, Ian. Israel has indicted Palestinian legislator Marwan Barghouti, charging him with running the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades. He has been charged with murder, attempted murder, and terrorist activities. Barghouti's attorney, Kader Shakirat, told reporters this is not a fair trial.
No, this is not a trial. This is a political and unfair. If the trial is fair, they have to release him immediately to save the peace process. Marwan, he's a political leader. By trying him, they're trying the peace process.
Barghouti says he's a political leader and not involved in violence. If convicted of murder, he could face life in prison. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected an appeal by Mexican citizen Javier Medina. Barring a last-minute intervention by Texas Governor Rick Perry, Medina is set to die by lethal injection at any time. Mexican President Vicente Fox attempted to intercede on Medina's behalf today, speaking with President Bush by phone. Medina was condemned for the shooting of an undercover narcotics officer in 1988. United Airlines is warning it may file for bankruptcy this fall. That's if the number two U.S. carrier cannot dramatically cut costs. The airline has lost record amounts of money since the September 11th attacks. Pilots and management have already agreed to pay cuts. Britain's deputy prime minister says lawmakers will be allowed to debate on whether the nation should join any U.S.-led attack on Iraq. But the final decision will ultimately rest with Prime Minister Tony Blair. About 160 lawmakers have signed a motion cautioning against military action. And a poll released this week shows about half the British public is against joining any such attack. We'll have more on the KPFK Evening News at 6:30. Now it's back to the Daily Review with your host, Ian Masters.
We have to think out of the box in totally pure, non-violent ways.
Hi, I'm Lily Tomlin, and this is A Passion for Survival with Dr. Helen Caldicott, a 12-part series featuring the world-renowned physician activist discussing the dangerous times we live in with specialists such as Michael Parenti, Julia Butterfly Hill, Noam Chomsky, and others.
Lockheed Martin gave huge amounts of money to both sides, like Enron did during the election and the like, and Congress passed a resolution saying we must get on with Star Wars as soon as possible. That's how Congress operates. Congress is not run by you, as you know, it's run by the corporations.
Join us this Thursday at 3 p.m. for A Passion for Survival with Dr. Helen Caldicott. That's this Thursday at 3 p.m. right here on KPFK Los Angeles 90.7 FM.
Welcome back to the Daily Review. I'm Ian Masters, not Helen Caldicott, but let's now begin with Cecilia Zarate-Lon, who is a co-founder and director of the Colombia Support Network. And today, Cecilia, a U.S. delegation arrived in Colombia to express support for the new president who was sworn in a week ago amid bombings and mortar attacks. It's led by Deputy Secretary of State Mark Grossman. There's more money on the way. But essentially what seems to be happening there is that Uribe ran on the platform of getting tough. He plans on getting tough. Is there a military solution to this civil war?
No. I think that the civil war, the only solution to the civil war is to negotiate a solution to the conflict in Colombia. Both sides seem to be raising the stakes to have a military confrontation, but I think it's impossible that either one of those sides win. So I think that the only, unfortunately, that's what seems to be coming, more confrontation. But I think that at the end, after millions of people are killed, we were going back to square one, which is a negotiated solution to the conflict.
And it's commonly believed in this country that this that this conflict is driven and financed by the drug trade. The FARC apparently get some 60% of their financing from the drug taxes on the drug business. And the paramilitaries get something like 80%, the right-wing paramilitaries, that is, get something like 80% of their financing. So is this, how do you separate this Colombian civil war from the war on drugs?
Well, the most important thing to remember is that this civil war did not start with the drug trade. This civil war goes back more than 40 years. And the origin and the cause of the war is the result of an exclusionary society that excludes the majority of its population from the social, political, economic, and human rights. And the drug trade is something that came about only in the last 20 years, and it came to complicate a situation that was already complicated because it brought more money and more arms and new actors in this situation. But it's not, drugs are not the cause of the war. Even if you let's assume that you take the drugs out of Colombia, the war will go on because the causes of the war are not the drugs.
And the causes are, as you said, a lack of social justice for the majority
basically,
of the people.
Now, basically.
Now, so who is fighting for social justice in this war?
Well, at this point, I think the people who are making pressure for social justice are the civilian society are caught in the middle. There are a myriad of organizations in Colombia who are peasants, cooperatives, women's groups, youth groups, teachers, unions, etc., journalists, lots of civil society organizations that are claiming for peace with justice in Colombia. And I think those are the people who are right now in most danger because they are caught in the middle of two very brutal right-wing and left-wing forces.
So you've got the right-wing and the left-wing, and let's just start with the government. This is a government that I imagine you don't believe does represent the hopes and aspirations of the people and have failed to bring social justice and economic equity. So what do you have elections for down there? I mean,
well, that's a good question, but well, I don't think Uribe's agenda in terms of the country, the economic issues in the country, is very different than Pastrana's. The only thing that is different between Pastrana and Uribe is that at least Uribe is upfront, what is saying clearly what is going on and what he wants to do. But I don't think there is a fundamental difference between Uribe or Pastrana or, let's say, President Samper and President Gaviria before. And the question of elections is an interesting one because the Colombian society, or the Colombian elites, have a deep interest in having this democratic facade to the international community, holding religiously elections every 4 years, and all the works of a democracy in order to pretend before the international community that Colombia is really a democracy.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Cecilia. I interviewed recently the husband of Ingrid Betancourt, who's mm-hmm. been captured by the FARC and is held for ransom, and the government doesn't really care about it because she has always claimed that the ruling class in that country are totally corrupted by drug money, and she mm-hmm. calls it a narco-democracy.
It's to me, it's a facade democracy.
Uh-huh.
It has been like that. The narco, again, I repeat, the drugs thing, although it's a very important factor right now, and is really the source of a lot of corruption, but it has always been like that. The thing to see in Colombia is that it presents itself as a democracy in order to pretend before the international community that all the forms of democracy are kept religiously It has the three powers, and they have beautiful buildings, but there is no real democracy. But it helps them to pretend that they are a democracy in order to have an international image, so they attract foreign investors and they... economic reasons, but the facade is coming down.
Well, now, let me again remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Cecilia Zarate-Leon, who is the co-founder and director of the Colombia Support Network here in the United States, which is a group of mostly Americans, I believe, who support the notion of peace and social... Yes, with justice in Colombia, and we're just painting a picture down there where there's none of it. On the far left, you have this kind of mindless brutality of the FARC. On the right, you've got the mindless brutality of the paramilitaries who are fronting for the military. And in the middle, you've got the vast majority of the people who want peace and justice. So who's organizing them, and how can you organize them when people are afraid of, you know, that any moment you'll get shot for being a leftist sympathizer or a rightist sympathizer?
Well, there are some of the things that I admire about Colombian spirit, because I have been there many times leading CSN delegations, and I have been at meetings with somebody has to come to that meeting, and that person cannot come because he was just killed. And suddenly there is a silence in the room, and somebody asks who is going to take his place in order to do the tasks that he or she was assigned. And there is always somebody who comes out and say, I will do that, knowing that I will be the next person to be killed. So, even in this situation of terror, Colombian people have been able to keep the struggle, the fighting for their activities, their freedoms, etc. I don't know, with the new legislation that is coming out with the new president, how things are going to change. But people have a tremendous courage to keep going.
Well, now, what is going to change is that there's going to be more war. That's pretty clear.
Yes.
And furthermore, it's going to be a guerrilla war that's going to move from the jungles into the cities.
Yes.
Where it will be extremely brutal. Mm-hmm. And the United States will be supporting the government.
Yes.
And the government has these death squads that do their dirty work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the United States people are going to be getting a sickening diet of the same stuff that they got during the El Salvador war,
mm-hmm.
where people that we support murder nuns and kill children and wipe
yes.
out villages.
Yes.
And so here am I trying to sort of report on this stuff and trying to make some sense out of it. And you're saying the drugs aren't a component, or they're not the main component, and yet that's the reason why we're told that we're supporting this war, and why the Clinton administration voted $1.7 billion, and the Bush are about to give billions yeah. more.
Well, you remember, the United States needs an excuse to go into internal affairs of other countries in order to justify their actions to the American people. But unfortunately, the American people are not very politically educated, and many of them believe whatever the government tells them. But in the case of Colombia, before, maybe in the 1950s and in the 1960s, the United States was very active in Colombia, using the excuse of communism. These guerrillas were Marxist-Leninists, etc. These same guerrillas now are called narco-guerrillas, which means that the name changes according to the times, but the basic issue is the same. They are a challenge to the United States plans in the Americas. Keep in mind that the United States wants to implement the free trade agreement of the Americas throughout the hemisphere. And at this moment, Colombia is the only country in the Western Hemisphere that is in the middle of a very bloody and brutal civil war. So the United States has to end that civil war at any cost. And if that cost means that they have to call it narco, whatever, that would be it in order to justify the action.
But just clarify one thing for me, just as we close here. This is a 40-year-old civil war.
Yes.
And you've gotten through saying that the people are caught in the middle between the left and the right.
Yes.
So if the U.S. wasn't involved, there'd still be bloodshed, wouldn't there?
Yes, yes.
So who's the honest broker here? Is there anybody that can... I mean, if you're saying the United States is not helping and exacerbating, that's one thing. But is there anything that anybody can do?
Yes, the U.S. people should support the civil society in Colombia, and they can do that by, I invite your audience to join the Colombia Support Network, for example, because what we do is we create chapters around the United States, and each chapter takes over or accompanies a poor rural community that is suffering the effects of the war in the countryside and supports all the small little groups that are in that community, such as cooperatives, women's groups, children's groups, youth groups, etc., teachers, and by accompanying that community from here and taking the issue of that community to your legislators in Congress and to the press in your local community, etc., you develop a grassroots movement that eventually will influence the United States to get away of, to look at the Colombian war and the foreign policy in a different way.
I thank you very much for joining us, Cecilia.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I've just speaking with Cecilia Zarate-Lohn, who's a co-founder and director of the Colombia Support Network. And they can be reached at www.columbiasupportoneword.net. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be back with Leonard Weinglass, who's one of the attorneys for the five Cubans convicted of espionage against the United States. Welcome back to the Daily Review. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Leonard Weinglass, who's the attorney for Antonio Guerrero, who is one of the five Cubans convicted of espionage against the United States. And, Leonard, you're trying to get a trial or a retrial or an appeal, I guess, going. They've already been convicted, and they're all in various federal prisons here in the United States. So let's begin with one. What are they convicted of?
Well, the indictment, which is the charging document, claims 26 separate counts, but there are really only three counts that are operative. One is a conspiracy to commit espionage. Secondly, a conspiracy against one of the five to commit murder. And thirdly, a conspiracy to fail to report that you are a foreign alien resident operating as an agent of a foreign country. Those are the three main claims. The rest are relatively minor.
And these five, what was their immigration status at the time of the arrest?
Well, two are U.S. citizens, so there's no immigration question with respect to them. Three are Cuban natives, and they came to the United States for purposes of investigating the terrorist network that exists in the southern Florida area.
You mean
war against Cuba.
The right-wing terrorist network you're referring
Yes, to. That's right.
Now, how did these people get here, though? I mean, you couldn't go to the embassy. There's an interest section, but you couldn't very well get a visa. I want to come to the United States and investigate right-wing Cubans.
Actually, that's a detail that I really can't answer because I don't know.
Okay.
I think it's rather relatively unimportant to the question at hand.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, I'm just wondering whether but the two Americans that were American citizens, they were living in Miami, obviously legally, right? They're U.S. citizens, right?
Yes, I mean, frankly, Ian, these are men who are serving life sentences.
Right.
Their status is really of no particular moment.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm not a citizen, and I can be booted out at any moment under the USA Patriot Act. So these things are relevant, I think. But let me ask you then about your particular client. What's he charged with, Antonio Guerrero?
Well, Antonio Guerrero is charged with conspiracy to commit espionage.
Mm-hmm.
And conspiracy to fail to file with the attorney general that he was a foreign agent.
Mm-hmm.
And they carry life sentences. And so he's serving a life sentence for the espionage count. Mm-hmm. But I have to point out that he was not charged with espionage. He was charged with conspiracy to commit. And the reason why the government charges it that way, which is what they have always done, is when they can't prove what's called the substantive case, they can't prove the reality of espionage, they charge a conspiracy, which is an unlawful agreement to commit the crime, without having the need to actually prove the crime itself.
And they, if they were monitoring the activities of the right-wing Cubans who are launching terrorist attacks against Cuba and against Cuban interests around the world, because you just have to recall that Orlando Bosch blew up a Cuban airliner out of Venezuela, killing, I believe, among a lot of passengers, the Cuban fencing team. Now, he is a Miami right-wing Miami Cuban, and he's actually, a friend of the current Assistant Secretary of State, Otto Reich. And furthermore, he was pardoned by George Bush Sr., even though he's an international terrorist. So these I can understand monitoring these people, but specifically, what did the government say that they did that's against the law?
Well, it's a question of how you read the law. The Espionage Act, which is Section 794 of Title 18, makes it a crime of espionage if you take national defense information from the United States, which either harms the United States, and then there's a big or benefits a third country. So the government's theory was, if you come to the United States and you seek information which will benefit Cuba, namely its right of defense against 40 years of terrorism inflicted on the country, then you run afoul of the espionage laws. And that's what this case was all about. And it raises a corollary in international law, which the United States is currently practicing, namely, what rights does a victim country have when it's the victim of terrorism to seek out the country that's harboring the terrorists in order to gain information to defend itself? That, in a nutshell, is what this case is about. What right does Cuba have to defend itself against the country that's harboring, knowingly harboring, the terrorist activity and doing nothing to stop it?
So, in other words, Fidel Castro has the right to make the same speech that George Bush recently made at West Point.
He would borrow it word for word.
That we have to go anywhere to preemptively stop people from attacking us who are terrorists.
And with considerably more evidence than George Bush has. One of the reasons why these five were arrested, this is a long story, they were under surveillance for several years. The reason why they were arrested was because in June of 1998, there was a meeting in Havana, at which time the Cuban Ministry of the Interior turned over to a visiting FBI delegation, a very high-level delegation, volumes of information they had collected on the terrorist network in Miami, as well as videotapes and audio tapes. It was 4 months after that, Ian, that they rounded up the five and arrested them.
And what was the role of the brothers to the rescue? Remember that they flew these light planes into Havana, and one of them was shot down. And there was, at the time, there was an accusation that there was inside information. Is that one of your defendants or one of the defendants in the case?
One of the defendants is charged with being involved in the shoot down of the two aircraft, in which four people died. But I have to say this briefly. The Brothers to the Rescue started, allegedly, as a humane operation to rescue rafters, people who were lost at sea. And I must say they did do that up until 1994, and they rescued a number of people. There were a lot of church groups and charity groups in the United States that was backing and supporting them, not because they were anti-Castro, but because they thought Brothers to the Rescue was performing a humane service, which it was. In 1994, the Clinton administration signed an agreement with Cuba that people who fled Cuba to come to the United States, if they made it to our shores, would be returned back to Cuba. That put Brothers to the Rescue out of business. At least it put them out of the raftering business. From 1995 on, they began using their aircraft for other purposes, namely to overfly Cuba. And they overflew Havana. They flew over the military sites. They flew over radar sites. They dropped leaflets in the city. They flew over the Capitol building. And the Cubans began a dialogue with the Clinton administration, warning the Clinton administration that these flights will not be tolerated. And yet they kept coming. In February of 1996, the Cubans had had it. And they did shoot down two planes, and four people, unfortunately and regrettably, died. But I lay that blame at the feet of the United States government and the Brothers to the Rescue, not Cuba.
Again, let me remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Leonard Weinglass, an attorney for Antonio Guerrero, who is one of five Cubans convicted of espionage against the United States. And Leonard is trying to get on appeal. What are you trying to get, a retrial or a hearing? But, I mean, basically, the problem is that the venue is Miami, where that's where they were tried in the first place, right?
Yes, essentially, an operation of the Cuban government was tried before the exile community. The result was foregone.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real travesty. In any other district in the United States, the five would have had a trial. And they very well should have been and would have been probably acquitted. But in Miami, facing a seven-month trial, facing the hostility that exists in that community. You know, Ian, in Miami, you cannot show a painting in an exhibit that was made in Cuba. You can't show a film at a film exhibition that was made in Cuba. You can't even have a Cuban athlete running in the Pan Am Games. But they tried five Cubans, allegedly agents of the Cuban intelligence service, in Miami. It's a complete travesty.
But again, it's worth reminding the audience that if you have terrorists here in the United States who are operating as terrorists against foreign countries, but they're based here in the United States, and they attack another country, and somebody is killed as a consequence, you can put people on trial who tried to tip off that country that was going to be the recipient of a terrorist attack from the soil of the United States. You go to jail for this bizarre law, which I didn't. I'm just trying to figure out how you could be charged with espionage. When you're actually trying to stop terrorism?
It's a very good question. The people who are supposedly assisting the U.S. and the U.S. agents themselves, who are operating in many different countries, are operating sometimes with, sometimes without the permission of the host country, the country that's hosting the terrorists. And to just give you numbers, which surprised me when I heard them, in the 42 years, Cuba has suffered 3,482 people killed as a result of these operations and over 2,000 injured. To put it in perspective, we suffered approximately the same number on September 11th. Of course, that was one day. But the U.S. is 25 times larger than Cuba. So you can imagine the impact of this casualty loss on the country of Cuba. And it is more than Israel has suffered so far, and the Palestinians have suffered jointly in the Intifada, too. So far, approximately 2,400 people have been killed on both sides. But a larger number than that have been killed in Cuba in 42 years, to be sure. But this is not a small matter. This is not dropping leaflets. We're talking about people who have engaged over the years in an armed attack on civilians in Cuba.
Well, that's why I would think, in the context of this new war on terrorism, Leonard Weinglass, that you'd have a strong argument, because you can't have it both ways. I mean,
yes.
And if the United States government, the President of the United States, pardons a convicted terrorist who bombed a civilian airliner, which is really the most egregious acts of terrorism that we suffer from. And remember, we had airliners hijacked and run into buildings here.
73 recently were killed.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's the same thing as flying a plane into, it's, you know, it's a,